Edie Marshall presents Jody Jackson's Gems. We appreciate Edie Marshall. We appreciate Jody Jackson because Jody should be getting hazard pay after what she witnessed yesterday in Milwaukee. I'm not really quite sure where to start. Was yesterday one of the hardest locker room post games you've ever had in your history of covering the Diamondbacks?
Yeah, for sure, Brad. It was a tough one. And there have been a few tough ones, but historically, you know, to lose after being up 8 was the worst in the history of the Diamondbacks franchise. And, you know, I've seen similar collapses. It's always hard to watch. This one was particularly hard because it just happened slowly over, you know, we can look at the last 3 innings, but really it started with Jordan Montgomery going 4 1/3, which is really not what you wanted to see him go deeper. You wanted to see him maybe a little more on the attack, being up with that big lead. Then you had Gilbert Diaz coming in, trying to cover a chunk. A guy that hadn't pitched in a while, a young man who is just coming in and, you know, doesn't have a ton of experience. He did okay, but, you know, there was an error over to first base, and it was kind of the little things that just piled up. And then you get to the 7th inning, Ryan Thompson, you know, he has trouble immediately, giving up 3 hits, and then he gets out of it. You know, he limits the damage. But the damage, you know, they were chipping away, and all of a sudden it went 8-3, 8-4. And then Joe Mantiply, I think what's so tough is Joe Mantiply in that 8th inning had 2 outs. And by the way, the bullpen had been great in the previous 3 games. They were unbelievable. I was watching those games thinking this is like last year's playoffs. They're just locking it down, whether it was Mantiply, Ginkle, Thompson, Puck, who wasn't here last year, obviously, but and with 2 outs, you know, the Brewers just came to life. I mean, they worked a walk. Churio worked a walk. They had great at bats. Ultimately, what was really a tough blow is Rhys Hoskins reaches down and gets the bat on a splitter from Justin Martinez and ties the game. Mm-hmm. And you're just sitting there thinking. And I had some people texting me earlier, like maybe 40 minutes earlier, saying, are they going to blow this game? And I'm thinking, like, no.
I'm not thinking that right now.
And I'm thinking, no. But, you know, if it happens. It happened, and that's what we saw.
Okay, so you're sitting there in the next to the dugout in your usual broadcast spot during the broadcast, correct?
Yes.
And you could see this meltdown starting to happen. Could you see it on the faces of the players?
Yeah, not really. Not until that 8th inning. I mean, you know, because again, many times in baseball, and many times as I've sat there, you know, 90 other times this year, or however many, you know, games that I've done. And you just weather that storm, and you really don't think that you would be giving up, what was it, 7 runs in 3 2/3? I think Torrey Lovello, you know, kind of threw that out at me in the post game, and you just don't think it will get to that point. And unfortunately, it got to that point yesterday.
So when you walk in there to do the post game with Torrey, does he look at you like, oh no, not you? Or you guys, I know it's a professional deal, but that's one of those. And what I've always liked about him is he stands in there. Some fans want him to lose his mind after games like that. What was that like when you had to walk in there to that yesterday, given the circumstance, given the time of year and everything?
Yeah, it was tough. I mean, luckily, you know, he knows that we're there to ask questions, find out what his view was on everything. But it is hard. And it's hard when you walk in and you see the players too, the like 3 hours before, well, actually given the length of that game, the whole game was kind of a slog, you know, but when you're up, you're like, okay, well, we're just going, this is just part of the process to get to the final product. You know, 4.5 hours, 5 hours before, we were all joking around. We were talking. We were all, you know, we were talking about baseball. We were talking about whatever. And then you walk in there and they just, you know, they let that one get away. And it was on a lot of different guys. It was on a lot of different pitchers primarily. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think with Torrey, there have been other situations like that. Nothing quite like that. This last week, I think, Brad, is a very difficult week. Really, you could go back you can go back this last 2 weeks, but you're down to the final, what is it now? It's six games.
Games.
And it gets real tense because then, everybody knows the enormity. And I think the thing is walking in there, that's the great thing though about Torre Lovello is look, they just took three of four from the Brewers. So I think there is a little bit of perspective, like how it went down was ugly and terrible. And when you lose a game like that, you think, I hope this isn't going to cost us. But they did take three of four. And I think if you look over the series, it was 4-3. They had the Brewers for seven. We knew that was going to be a big factor. And they went 4-3. And so you have to keep that perspective. And I think he never gets too high or too low, which is great. You could see that he was disappointed. You could almost imagine there was disbelief. He didn't stand there and say, I'm in disbelief, but that's how he had to be feeling. And yet, you got to just maintain the calm and you got to just, I love Jake McCarthy has a great perspective at, and, I didn't talk to him personally, but I saw a quote that said like, we hope we win the next two series and then that's enough to get us in. And I think a lot of these guys, they do, you can't sit there gripping over this. You can't be like, oh my, you can't be, Justin Martinez was sitting in the dugout for quite a while after this game, but as to a man, hopefully, now they come out and flush that, move ahead, whether you lost it, whether you had a lead and lost or whether you just were not even leading the whole time. You can't worry about it, but it's a very tense week because you know that you've worked so hard to be in this position. And
Sure.
now, the Braves are the ones that are outside looking in. You hope that, the Mets are playing really well. The Mets and the Braves do have to play each other, but if you spend a lot of time thinking about all that, that's wasted time too. Just worry about yourself.
Well, and I'm not going to hammer this point too hard into the ground, but I do think it's worth mentioning. I'm not saying if Paul Sewald were active and eligible that yesterday would have been any different, but it's what you and I talked about 2, 3 weeks ago, that you're going to get into a space in the final 10 games. You're just going to need to get a couple of outs and you're going to have to go through Justin Martinez. And yeah, it was not much. It was just a ball put in play. That said, at the start of this season, and you want to bring Jamar along to where he does get into a week to go in the season, we are in a struggle and you have somebody just blows away the opposition, and that didn't happen. And so I'm not going to go down the, well, Paul Sewald were there, because I don't know, but it sure would help if that bullpen had a few more arms. That's just
You are correct. You are right. There are some guys down there that are thrown out in some low leverage situations with the team right now that are on this team that are guys that you don't feel great about in those situations. So if you have Paul Sewald back, he's on the mend. Ryne Nelson is on the mend.
right.
Ryne Nelson will help you as a I don't know what I don't I guess it depends on exactly how healthy he is and where he's at. He'll help you. I mean, we know that what
Well,
he can do,
Jody.
and you know that Paul Sewald will help you. But these guys have to be healthy and ready to go. But yeah, that all and AJ Puck was down. That's going to happen. They're pushing these guys too. Oh, and obviously Ginkel wasn't really available either. And that's this time of year, you're pushing guys to pitch every day, but they have to tell you in the morning, I'm feeling good, I'm ready to go.
Well, it's what you said earlier about Jordan Montgomery. Okay. If it's Jordan Montgomery, it's pretty much scripted. It's 4 1/3. The pitch count's going to be up
Well,
high. So if you have
I
Ryan
think we were
Nelson,
all hoping it was going to be more because he had about 90 to 95 pitches to play with, I think, because he went 80, he was able to go, and you're like, you really need to get five or five and a third or ideally six out of that.
because as we're sitting here today, Montgomery's turn is going to come up Friday or Saturday. Okay. And if Ryan Nelson is able to give you anything, and Montgomery's sitting there dinking around in the second or third inning, I mean, Torrey's just got to manage his starters. You know what Merrill's going to give you unless that cramp thing kicks in again. You saw that happen. You think you know what
That
Zach.
was shocking to me a little bit, yeah. And it was warm in Milwaukee in the stadium. It wasn't warm outside. It was warm in the stadium for whatever reason. They don't have air in there. They have heat, And the whole thing is, this is going to be a wild week, Brad. I'm glad you brought that up because Jordan Montgomery is going to come up, and you can't you don't want to be looking back thinking, is that going to cost you? Again, this is not all on Jordan Montgomery, but again, it was a chain of, that's what's so horrible about that loss yesterday. I mean, or really, it's not like you're pinning it on one guy, but it was a chain of command with the pitching. It had to be so frustrating for the coaching staff to watch. Now, this is that time of year though, where you have to do whatever you can to get in. And that's why Gabby Moreno, that's another situation where, and everyone's, look, I am tired of what I've seen just in the last 12 hours of the medical staff. I mean, look, guys get hurt throughout the entire league. This is a time of year you are, as the saying goes, damned if you do, damned if you don't. I mean, if you don't play, people are saying, well, why,
Why is it there?
I mean, if they're, these guys are trying normally in April, March, June, July, March, April, June, July, even into August, you are making sure you're 100%. Right now, and it's more of a football mentality, really, and they do it in football all the time. I mean, you don't have to be perfect to necessarily go play in crunch time. And so right now, I'm sure the medical staff would love to take every guy who's nicked up and just set them off on the side. That's not how it works right now.
No, that's a good
If
point.
you can play without ramification of hurting yourself down the line, now no one's out there risking injury that's going to set them back like 8 months, okay? But I think that right now you have to play it. You have to play it on a fine line of what can we do? What do we? How badly do we need these guys? And make no mistake, from pitch calling to the running game, Gabriel Moreno is as important as any one person on this team.
Jody Jackson's Gems, brought to you by E.D. Marshall Jewelers. We move over to the Cardinals. They didn't get much done offensively against Detroit. Detroit is a team that went a long ways last season. I'm not too low about the performance. I'm not too high about the performance. The last time I checked, the team went through a season undefeated. It would have been the Miami Dolphins a long time ago. And so, okay, you come up short against Detroit. Is it fixable? Is it solvable? And you look at the team now through a few games and say, I think they're much better. I'm kind of on the side of the street of, I don't celebrate a loss often. My expectations have been 7, 8 wins. I didn't have them beating the Lions, but they were competitive, Jody.
Yeah, they were competitive for sure. And I think you have to really like what you saw from the defense, basically shutting out the Lions in the second half. I think what was disappointing is coming off a game where Kyler Murray, again, 41 to 10 was giving, gives everyone this high, but was it real? Was 41 to 10 really what this team is? I mean, they put it on and it was a lot of fun. I mean, let's not pretend that it wasn't. You go from a perfect passer rating to a rating of around 76. And I just think, again, people now expect more of Kyler Murray with the weapons that he has, Marvin Harrison Jr. And you saw that in the front. It was 7-7 after he throws that touchdown pass to Harrison, which was a very nice throw and a very nice catch. And I think that it's clear to me Marvin Harrison Jr. is going to be special. And it's just a matter of when you take these shots to him, are you going to connect? Are you going to just misfire, or is it going to cost you, which it did on the interception? But I think in general, it's hard to look at a game where you only rush for 77 yards, and if you're unable to run, it just makes everything harder. And it was interesting too, they were running play action in a game where they really couldn't run the ball, which tells me that they didn't feel good about just, dropping back and throwing the ball. So play ag, we all know play action isn't really going to work all that well unless you're actually able to run it. So, they were 1 for 9 on third down. That was a killer. And yet there were some positives in Michael Wilson, 8 catches for 64 yards. I hated to see that injury to Trey McBride. I don't know how long that's going to keep him out. Certainly it looked like he had a concussion. So while there were some good moments, but again, the offense with being one-dimensional is very difficult. And yet, elite players, and I think that's where now you come back to Kyler Murray, and I think that's why he was disappointed with himself, is that great quarterbacks, even when they are forced to be one-dimensional, make enough plays to win the game. But the Lions are a tough opponent. I'm not down on this team at all, don't get me wrong. I mean, Buffalo, what was it, 6-point game? this is a 7-point game. These are winnable games. And again, that way, that's another source of frustration is I'm sure they're sitting there thinking, man, we could be 2-1, we could be 3-0, all these woulda, coulda, shoulda. Now I say though, how are you going to learn from this? How are you going to go forward from this? They were down to their, Jackson Barton played pretty well in his second string guy in there.
Great.
Or I should say third string, right? Third string because Beecham, you started with Beecham as your backup. And then Charlie Heck had to come in and, play the end of that game. So they had some issues offensively, but again, very tough opponent. Aiden Hutchinson, one of the best in the league to do it. They kind of, controlled him a little bit. Barton had some help out there, but I'm not down on this team, but I do think again, offensively, I like that they took some shots, but they weren't able to connect enough to be able to flip the script and win the game.
No, I think that's all you and I are aligned on that. I want to talk to you about Al McCoy. So Al passed, as you know, and the story with Al is has been coming out from all corners of how genuine, how many people he helped in his career, a lot of things behind the scenes and all that. You weren't with the Suns much, right? So you didn't see Al day in and day out. But I'm sure you had to have come across him through your time here in the Valley. And if you have some thoughts on Al and his life and legacy.
For sure. I mean, Brad, I was with the Suns. I was covering them about 2000, some great years, some great seasons, 2007 until about 2012, rotating in as a sideline reporter. And, but, oddly enough, it was more, I feel like on game day, we were all just doing our business. It was more the interactions that I had with Al McCoy at different events and just now hearing all the stories. It's the same man that I always knew, just incredibly kind. And a very thoughtful guy, and just a very a guy that everyone's like, it's Al McCoy, he's a legend, but he never gave off the vibes of, I mean, we all know in this business it's easy to have an ego or something like that, and certainly Al McCoy, could have done that, his voice being the soundtrack of Suns games for so long, and yet just an unassuming man who was so kind and so joyful all the time that you saw him. Just you could tell he loved what he did. How else do you do it for 51 years? And
Right.
it was always amazing to me, just from the standpoint of how at 89 years old was he still so terrific at his job? And so just an unbelievable when people say he is the, one of one. He's the only one. There is only one Al McCoy. And we were so lucky to have him on the call. I mean, I did not grow up here, but, to so many people, he is so special to them because they listened to him all their lives. And I just, he lived a fantastic life. It is so sad that we won't have him with us, but it's more about celebrating 91 years of an amazing man who so many people loved because of what a great human he was.
I called Al a couple of years ago and said, let's get caught up on lunch. And we met at the Henry in downtown Phoenix. And we walk in together and you could see people's heads turn. We go over and we sit in the booth and we have lunch. And a few people stop by just to say, I've loved listening to you through the years, so on, so on, so on. Then we get up to leave and most people that were sitting at the bar or coffee area at the Henry stopped him and wanted autographs and wanted pictures. And it's almost as though he knew that that was going to happen. And the way that he went about it just that day, and the way that Al through the years, when I got here in 93 and I did the Suns pre and post for years, and I would see Al and how he went about his preparation and his business. And Jody, when someone is really in love with the craft, they do the craft. If someone's sitting there saying, I'm just going to get a check, they're pretty much just going to get a check. And in our industry, and Al, never once did I see him not show up for games saying, oh, I got another game tonight or any of that stuff. And win or lose, you couldn't tell. The ultimate compliment on my end, Al, was I could never tell tuning on a game if the Suns were winning or losing. I couldn't tell. And if the
Yeah.
Suns were bad, he would say they were bad. And if the Suns were good, he would say they were good. Of course, he wanted to call a good game. Nothing worse than, being around a team that's lousy. So it was like the consummate pro being around him in all facets.
Yeah, he was a guy that would be very honest. And I think that was a great quote that I saw was that he learned early on that being a homer was not going to serve the broadcast well.
No.
And I think that's so true. And so he let him, and he would let the officials have it, or he'd let a player, not in any mean spirit, like with players, of course. And that's the thing is, when the players have so much respect and love for him, some of the most cherished photos I see are he and Devin Booker, who had a special relationship. And yeah, he was exactly what you said, Brad, a consummate pro. And something that's so cool that you were able to learn from him when you were doing those shows with the Suns. And I'm sure it was awesome to be around that. We all have those people in our lives, and just he's a great example for so many. But I think more than anything, he just loved what he did it for as long as he could, and that's the legacy of McCoy.
Yeah, no, that's a good way to put it. E.D. Marshall Jewelers brings you Jody Jackson and Jody Jackson's gems. You got the gems on. Like, I like that.
I do have the gems on. The gems now, after that last road trip, hopefully there's some postseason road coming. I still feel good about that. But gosh, I always come back after a trip and it's like gotta unpack. So I was like, I gotta get the gems on today.
You go.
And magically it just is the Monday is better.
We'll see you next week. Appreciate the visit.
Right, thanks, Brad.
Time to chop it up with the great John Wilner. You know what makes John so great? Nationally syndicated columnist. He's been a part of what we do here at Sports 360 for the last few years. It's always great to see John's content show up on the site. But what makes John so great is he and I both agreed that BYU would be 4-0 at the start of the season and that they'd have a really good defense for the first time in forever. He also predicted that Illinois and Indiana would be really good and that James Madison would put 70 on North Carolina. Yeah, that's that John Wilner who joins us
That's right. I predicted all that, and yet for some reason I didn't bother to put any money on it in Vegas. So that's why I'm still here doing this, right? Yeah, crazy stuff as always in college football. Unexpected success or failure is going to come up. You just don't know where. And BYU is a great example of that. Picked to the for the bottom half of the Big 12. Who would have figured they would blow Kansas State out? That was something else.
Kalani's going to get fired. He's on the short
Yeah.
list. Oh, and by the way, their defense, which BYU has never had defense. It doesn't matter. It goes all the way back to the WAC. It's always 58 to 49. Last possession, Jim McMahon, Robbie Bosco. Go right down the list, Steve Young. It's just, that's the part of it, John, that I was watching that game the other night, and it was as though Kansas State just got out of Manhattan, walked in and said, holy bleep, I don't know
Yeah.
what we're going to do here. They never
Yeah, no, it was something else. And it turned quickly with all those turnovers and that one of the craziest punt returns you'll ever see. That was bananas. The whole thing was kind of next level. But yeah, BYU's defense is legit. And they played really well on defense, at SMU, for instance, right? SMU just bombed TCU. BYU went in there on a Friday night and beat the Mustangs. So I don't know that I'm ready to call BYU a contender in the Big 12, but certainly they look like a top half team, no doubt.
Your CFP today, it's not going to include North Carolina ever.
No.
Poor Mac Brown. I love Mac Brown. Do you like Mac Brown?
Sure, I do like Mac Brown. Everybody likes Mac Brown,
You gave up
but
70 to JMU. Come on.
now,
How good?
JMU is really they're one of the best group of five programs there is, but there's no way they should put, and North Carolina's got a bunch of injuries, right? Out without its quarterback. There's still no excuse for giving up 70 points to James, to anybody. But James Madison, it's outrageous. If Mac Brown were not Mac Brown, he'd be on the hot seat right now. But certainly, you would have to think this might get him a lot closer to retirement.
Well, and they have Duke this week. Duke's undefeated. We all had Duke as undefeated. So Duke, North Carolina, this isn't basketball we're talking about. This is an enormous football game. And I would agree with you. If in this day and age of we are paying you guys to go get your roster put together and you're not getting it done, Big Cigar is saying, you don't beat Duke this week, maybe, John, there's a change there.
I'll be curious to see how much movement there is for an in-season change with a guy like Mack Brown, who's in his second tenure with North Carolina, one of the great coaches in the school's history. We'll see. That's a tough one. That's like politically, that gets a little bit tough. He would have to initiate publicly any kind of change, especially during the season. And yeah, Duke is quite the surprise. Lost their coach, lost their quarterback, Riley Leonard of Notre Dame. Here they are. ACC is a little bit nuts. It's not quite Big 12 bananas, but it's nuts. I mean, Cal's doing well. Stanford won at Syracuse. You know, Florida State obviously struggling. It's a little bit upside down in the ACC so far.
Sure, and you have Stanford Clemson this weekend.
Yeah, tough for Stanford. Went out to Syracuse on Friday, come home, start fall quarter classes today, and then they got to turn around and go to Clemson, which looked really good against NC State and may have found something offensively. So that's potentially a big problem for Stanford.
Let me go back on coaching changes for a minute. It used to be that if you knew that you were going to make a change, you would make the change as the season was coming to an end, so you could get out in front of it. You'd be the first ones to say, okay, we're going to be able to go get whoever we want.
Yep.
And has that changed now because of the CFP, where, and we'll get the CFP in a minute, but if you're still alive and you make the CFP and you're in demand, let's just say it's the group of five coach that is going to be in demand because he took his team to the CFP. That coach cannot go take something else or even interview probably until it's all wrapped up. So is the coaching cycle, the carousel that will happen every year, is it going to be later now, John, with the CFP, do you think?
I think it could. It's going to end later potentially. I mean, the CFP championship game is January 20th.
Right.
But it may start earlier with in-season firings. Clay Helton's a good example. USC fired him, I want to say it was September 11th, 12th, 13th of 2022. It was after a bad loss at home to Stanford. So you signal to everybody we're making a change. You let your players know this isn't going to continue. We're being proactive. But the problem, is finding somebody. Not only do you have the CFP situation, but the other dynamic is the early signing window and the transfer portal, which are in early December. You want to be able to go into the transfer portal then with a head coach installed, but it gets tough. Politically, you got to have everything lined up. Financially, you got to have everything lined up because of these massive buyouts. Very complicated situation. The other piece, a lot of schools like to wait until their bye week because then that gives you 2 weeks to get the interim coach, typically somebody promoted from within, set before a game. You don't want to fire your coach on Monday and you got to have the interim coach and the team on Saturday. You'd rather have 12 or 13 days for that transition. Yeah. So schools like, say, Florida.
They're on their bye week this week.
Yeah, so we'll see if they make a change with Billy Napier. But that, I think, is typically, I want to say Colorado did that with Carl Durrell. Typically, the bye week is the time to do it if you're making an in-season change.
Or it could be Arizona State and Herm resigned, which was not true. Or please get out of here, which is true. But they still paid him, which is true. And, you know, so that's my own little.
That's a whole other story. The fact
that's a whole half hour on that.
You got all that money.
John Wilner with us for a few minutes as we look at the college football playoff. Okay, we're 4 weeks in of games. And on the CFP side, for the fans this year, it's 12 teams. We don't have rankings that have come out as of yet. John, can you pretty much tell the upper end of the CFP? Like, it doesn't matter what happens with Alabama, Georgia in the CFP this coming Saturday. One of those two teams, or both those teams, rather, they're going to make it, right? Or am I getting too far ahead of myself?
The loser will probably still make it. This is an example of a game that doesn't have quite the impact or the ramifications that it would if it was a four-team CFP? Because the loser is still involved. For Georgia, it's interesting. They have to play, in addition to Alabama, they got to play Texas, Mississippi, and I believe they're playing Tennessee on the road. All those games are on the road. Brutal schedule.
Yep.
They don't have as much flexibility as maybe Alabama because of that schedule, but certainly it's not an elimination game. Just like the USC-Michigan game. Well, maybe it was a slight elimination from Michigan. I don't know. But USC is still in the playoff hunt, even though they lost at Ann Arbor. So in that regard, these kind of games don't have quite the impact. The loser's still in it. An SEC team that finishes with two losses is getting in the playoff. An SEC team that finishes with three losses might get in the playoff. The complexion of the playoff race right now is all SEC. I mean, just look at the AP rankings. I think the SEC's got five of the top six teams, everybody but Ohio State. They could end up with five teams with the automatic qualifier and four at-large bids. Tennessee, Alabama, Georgia, Texas, Ole Miss, all right in the mix. All those teams can afford to lose twice and still get in.
What do you make out of Saturday's game at Tuscaloosa?
It's the first time they've played since 2020 during the regular season. I was looking this up. For all the postseason matchups they've had in the SEC championship game or even the playoff, this is the third time in 15 years they've played on a campus site during the regular season. 2015, they played in Athens. 2020, they played in Tuscaloosa. So it's rare in that regard. I think Georgia's better. Alabama's been waiting for this game, looked pretty good against Wisconsin, but I just think Georgia's better. We'll see. Should be a great game. And interestingly, there's a game in Boise Saturday night that in some ways has more playoff implications, Washington State, Boise State, than the Georgia-Alabama game.
Because?
Boise, Washington State has just as much, if not more, implications for the playoff race than Alabama, Georgia, because Boise's trying to get the automatic qualifier for the group of five. So the schools like Memphis, Liberty, James Madison that we referenced earlier, Toledo, they all want Boise to lose because they're all trying to get that group of five automatic bid. Meanwhile, here you got the Cougars. They're 4-0. They beat Washington, Texas Tech. They just survived against San Jose State. They can only get in the playoff as an at-large team. Because of what's happened in the Pac-12. But if they're 12-0, they're going to probably get a bid and take an at-large bid away from the Big Ten or the SEC. Could they go 12-0? Unlikely. But Boise is by far the toughest game they've got left. So if Washington State comes out of this game Saturday night 5-0, they're going to be heavily favored in their last seven games. And all of a sudden, maybe Washington State becomes a party crasher for an at-large bid that the SEC and Big Ten thought they were going to get. That's why the game matters on both sides, the Boise State side for the AQs and the Washington State side for the at-larges.
Utah, Arizona, what do you make out of that one?
Looks a lot different than it did a few weeks ago, doesn't it? I mean, even though Arizona's coming off a bye, you look at how Utah played against Oklahoma State, think, boy, this is a brutally difficult game for the Wildcats, given how they played against Kansas State, which just then goes into BYU and gets bombed. Right. I love about college football how a set of results alter, you know, it's like the third connections or third dimensional chess in some ways. They alter our perceptions about games. I think Arizona's in big trouble. We'll see if Cam Rising can play. Obviously, Utah went to Oklahoma State and won that game with fantastic defense without Rising. I don't know what his status is, but Isaac Wilson certainly can make some plays. I can't wait for this game because for Arizona, this is really a tipping point game. If they go in and lose after losing to Kansas State, then the expectations for their season have to be completely recalibrated, not to competing for the Big 12 title, but for hoping for a solid finish and a decent bowl game.
John Wilner with us. Let's flip over to expansion. So every Monday now, I think when we get together, I have to ask you, is there a sense that something is going to happen in the Pac-12 in terms of adding on schools this week, John? Is this another week of adding schools?
I believe this will be a week of adding schools. It could happen today. tomorrow, next 72 hours, but I am pretty sure something is going to happen. Exactly what remains to be seen. They are trying to get schools from the American. They're trying to get Memphis, South Florida, UTSA, Texas, San Antonio, Tulane. They are trying to increase the scope of the footprint for a variety of reasons, kickoff times, media money, kneecapping the American to become clearly the best of the group of five leagues. If they can't get those schools from the American, they'll recalibrate and focus on the Mountain West, UNLV. UNLV couldn't make it no matter what. Maybe Utah State. I don't really know who else. There's not a lot of great options left in the Mountain West besides UNLV. We'll see. They may look at basketball schools like Gonzaga, Grand Canyon, St. Mary's. I think they've got several different plans. All of it kind of hinges on whether they can get the likes of Memphis and Tulane. Those are their primary targets.
Well, it's interesting you bring that up because this morning the Big 12 sent out a release that they are adding more games on their media rights deal with Brett Yermark leading the way with CBS. And so when you bring up Grand Canyon and Gonzaga and St. Mary's, WCC schools, how do you think that would work? So there'd be no football coming in. And is that okay with Brett Yermark? Because we're going to have like a basketball group along with a football group. Help me out here.
Yermark believes there is more value in college basketball than any other commissioner in college sports does. He is a basketball guy, worked for the NBA, and he's looking long-term. Mm-hmm. How can I best position the Big 12 basketball to make a ton of money for us in the 2030s, which is why he has pursued Gonzaga, Connecticut, why they're doing this. It's kind of a tonnage issue, you know, for media. More games works for streamers. If you figure that streaming is going to be a bigger deal even in 5 years than it is now, more quality games would help. It's all part of his master plan to add to the Big 12's basketball package so they can essentially split up basketball and football. To this point, college sports, when you do a TV deal, your basketball, your men's basketball, and your football are together.
Together, yeah.
Yermark is eventually looking to split those two things and to sell Big 12 basketball as its own product with its own network partners, and then to sell Big 12 football as its own product. This is all part of his master plan for 2030 and beyond for college basketball.
So GCU, I'll just bring it locally here. Grand Canyon agrees to go to the West Coast Conference after this upcoming season. This will be their last year in the WAC. They've already said they're going to go to the WCC, but before they even bounce a basketball, they could, John, could conceivably already be headed to the Big 12 by 2033. Is that what you're suggesting?
I am suggesting that anything is possible if you can write a big enough check.
Got it.
And Grand Canyon can write a pretty big check.
Yes, they can.
So that is a big piece of it. The Big 12's media deal expires in 2031. So if there's going to be a Grand Canyon going into the Big 12 it would be for the 2031-32 basketball season. Mm. They could conceivably, yes, play in the WCC. I don't know the details of their contract with the WCC, whether there is an option to look elsewhere after a certain period of time, exactly when it expires. But they will. You know, there has never been a contract that can't be broken in realignment. And as we have said before, billable hours are the number one overall seed in college sports realignment.
That is a great line. I absolutely love that. Anything else that's caught your radar this week? I mean, I could go on and on and on about Fox Big Noon Kickoffs doing UCF Colorado. It's like Dion's going to show
Colorado,
up.
Colorado, Colorado, Colorado.
The Colorado Network, John.
It is. The ratings for Colorado games are down. They were off the charts early last season. They're down comparatively. They're still doing really well. And the way that game ended the other day against Baylor with the Hail Mary and the overtime, that I'm sure is part of the reason they're on broadcast network once again this week, even though it's UCF and there's not a whole lot of appeal nationally in UCF.
Yeah. You know, I'm hoping UCF is up 30-0 at halftime because of this. The way that it works. I'll let you go.
I'm sure it'll be exciting.
Thanks for your time as always, John. Appreciate it.
Thanks very much.
And we're back with more after this timeout.